On the show today, we have Robert Eiler back on the program. He is the president of Economic Forensics and Analytics and also Sonoma State University economics professor. So we have Robert come on periodically to talk about, well, the economy and how it affects credit unions. So in this discussion is no different. We talk about interest rates. We talk about inflation, recessions, lending, deposits, housing, labor, and much, much more. Robert covers it all in a very short amount of time. So we hope you guys check it out. Welcome back to our show. And on today's program, we have one of our favorite recurring economic guests is Mr. Robert Eiler. You are president of Economic Forensics and Analytics and also Sonoma State University economics professor. You got pulling double duty there, Robert. Wow. Good for you.
Yeah. Try to stay busy.
Yeah, you are. You are indeed. So we always enjoy having you on a few times of the year, just giving us an economic outlook. And obviously, the economy is top of mind for just about everybody these days, no matter where you are on the planet. So today is no different. So I just want to start out with the big question first. What's the state of the economy today heading into the holidays and then turning the corner in 2023? And then we'll dive into some details here.
Cool. So yeah, I mean, state of the economy is basically one that's starting to slow down. In a sense, the relatively high inflation that's now led to the Federal Reserve reacting by increasing interest rates very aggressively here in 2022 is all the seeds of starting to slow down hiring, slowing down consumption, slowing down business investment, and all the things that we as macroeconomists kind of talk about that would begin the movement toward recession. Now, I'm sure in a minute we're going to come back to whether or not we're in recession, going into recession, going to miss a recession. The thing for most people, and this is the key, is that don't get caught up in whether or not we're going into recession. It's really about the evolution of the economy to a slower level, whether that's negative, very low positive. It's going to feel slower in 2023, regardless of the so-called declaration of recession.
Okay. Yeah. Good to know. Yes. That's a great clarification for a lot of people out there, because that seems to be the $64,000 question. It's like, are we going to be in a recession or not? This is going to be kind of a rapid fire discussion here. So one of the things here, we're going to be talking about the recession. So can it be avoided, or are we going to get into one, or what's your take on the whole recession thing? Cause it seems to be kind of a mystery to a lot of folks right now.
Yeah, no, it's really important to think about how recession is declared. So in the first two quarters of 2022, we had negative real growth of GDP, which it generally, from a textbook standpoint, kind of becomes the technical recession. Right. But we bounced out of that in the third quarter. It doesn't mean that all the warnings and all the sort of challenges of the economy, given higher interest rates, relatively high inflation, and a slowing level of jobs growth, is going to lead to in the economy over the next 9 or 12 months. Mm-hmm. So the key about recession is just think it's not as important to think about whether or not the economy is going to have negative growth and an increase in jobs. It's really about when those two things are coupled together. That's right. When you get the declaration of recession. Mm-hmm. We had two negative quarters, but we still had jobs growth. So that's why we did not hear recession get declared in the first two quarters of 2022. But right now, all the conditions are there to kind of presuppose that as we go into 2023, we should have at least one or two quarters of negative growth in 2023. And we're going to see jobs growth slow down and unemployment start to creep up. And that's going to creep us closer to a declaration of recession through the combination of those things changing.
Yeah, because that seems to be what a lot of people are talking about is the jobs front is like, the labor market's pretty healthy, but oh my gosh, we're borderline on in a recession. How does that happen? So it's very odd, I would think, and especially for a lot of people. So
it is. So when interest rates go up like this, you have to expect that job openings are going to start to fade, and we've already seen that. You should expect the unemployment rate to creep up a little bit, and we've already heard about jobs being cut specifically in larger tech companies. Those kind of make the headline news, but we're starting to see it creep into a lot of other industries. The critical factor is how that movement is coupled with people potentially reemerging that were not in the labor force. So the other thing that makes this situation even more unique, if you want to put it that way, is the pandemic and its shadow effects on the labor market and the macro economy. So if there's a bunch of people, and there's a lot of debate about this, if there's a bunch of people who left the labor force under the supposition that there'd be the shadow effect of the pandemic, are those folks now going to reemerge as potential workers because of relatively higher wages and job openings still being there?
Yeah.
Now, if that happens, then we're going to get this creep up of unemployment regardless of what happens with job loss. So we have to be cautious as to the causes of the creep up of unemployment. And it's really more important to think about the total level of employment fading than the unemployment rate creeping up because of that potential re-entry of workers.
Okay.
So those are kind of like you said, it makes for a relatively unique labor market situation in an otherwise sort of cloudy headwind situation in the economy.
Right. That's going to be interesting to watch in 2023 for sure as well. Oh my gosh. A whole nother wrinkle to consider as well. So let's talk about interest rates. Obviously you talked about earlier, I mean, and we saw it dramatically, the dramatic increases in 2022. So what's going to be happening in 2023 in your opinion, or what you're seeing on the horizon here? Are they going to continue to increase? Are we going to level off, or what's going to be the happenings, if you will?
Yeah. So the signals we're getting out of the Federal Reserve, and this is kind of what most macroeconomists thought would start to happen toward the end of this year, especially when there was these successive so-called jumbo increases of the federal funds rate, is that we expected that the acceleration of those interest rates at the Federal Reserve sets were going to start to slow down. And then we're getting those signals from the Federal Reserve. But we should expect that in December, in a couple of weeks, we should hear that interest rates are going to pop up one more time in 2022, mm-hmm. and then start to fade in terms of that increase. We might see a couple more quarter point increases in 2023 if inflation doesn't quite get down to the goal structure the Federal Reserve has set. And a lot of this is kind of black boxish in terms of what's truly the goal structure in terms of a month-on-month or quarter-on-quarter reduction in inflation that then signals to the Federal Reserve they need to tone it down. Mm-hmm. The key right now is not so much how much higher the Federal Reserve is going to go with rates, but how is that going to start to affect all maturities through along the yield curve? And what does that mean for so-called yield curve flatness or steepness? Because that's when credit unions and banks and just lending in general starts to get affected. And we haven't really had those effects yet because short rates, due to how many deposits we had on hand, mm-hmm. have not really increased yet because banks and credit unions don't necessarily need to attract deposits. They had a lot.
Oh, yeah.
Well, these deposits are starting to fade and we're starting to see those short rates creep up. Yep. So as lending rates and short rates, or what you can think of as the deposit rate or the cost of funds, start to creep closer to each other, mm-hmm. that normally is a good sign from a macroeconomic standpoint that we're going to see an economy slowing down because banks and credit unions, lenders in general, are going to be more reticent to lend into an environment where their cost of funds and their, let's say, marginal revenue mm-hmm. from adding one more dollar of loans is starting to creep closer to each other. That's why we don't like yield curve flatness or inversion in lending markets.
Okay. Yeah. Oh, there's such a science to all of this. It's so fascinating to talk to
folks. We hope that
like
there's
you.
A science. I mean, there's, you know, it's a tricky science, but hope that there's at least some scientific aspect that we have a little bit more predictability as a result of the change in those variables.
Well, let's talk about the other I word, and you mentioned that like probably 10 times already in this, it's inflation. So are we going to continue? Are we going to see it level up? Because obviously raising the interest rates, that was to kind of stave off inflation. That was kind of why they did it in a number of reasons. So what are you seeing with inflation going into the new year?
Yeah, so most of the data I watch suggests that we're going to see inflation decelerate, but not necessarily go back down toward the long run goal of the Federal Reserve, which is somewhere between 2% and 2.5%. And I'll come back to why that's important in a second.
Okay.
We do expect in 2023 and 2024 for inflation as the positive change in general prices of goods and services to start to go down to a lower level, but not necessarily, you know, stop moving. So that's something else that people have to understand is that inflation generally is positive. And we like positive inflation because that means there's growth on the demand side of the economy that's sort of pulling, if you want to put it this way, prices behind it.
Yep.
The problem with the current situation, and this has been something that's baffled economists around the world, is how much of the inflation is explained by the demand side of the economy versus the supply side of the economy. We train and we think about policy as affecting the demand side of the economy and that most inflations are demand driven. But this one, we know there are supply chain problems. For example, the railroad situation happening right now in the United States, if that were to go sideways and there was to be a railroad strike and kind of a slowdown of movement of goods on rail, that could lead to some really weird supply side problems in the macroeconomy that would probably lift up prices in the short term. But policy raising interest rates does not necessarily cure that. So the pandemic left the shadow effect of supply chain issues and China's zero COVID policy. They're trying to work that out and trying that has a lingering effect.
Yeah.
And so if inflation is, let's say, 40% supply side and 60% demand side, rising interest rates will not necessarily cure that supply issue.
Oh my God.
So that's the conundrum that policymakers worldwide are dealing with. And that's why this inflation is so stubbornly high still, is because it still has the supply element. And economists have sort of now bought into the idea that it's not all demand this time. And that's what we talked about, the so-called transitory inflation originally. Mm-hmm. We figured that it's because the supply side will kind of work itself out. It hasn't yet.
Gosh, oh my gosh. I mean, it's almost kind of like, you know, we had the supply issues coming out of the pandemic. It's almost like you're out of the frying pan and into the fire situation type of thing with the whole supply issue right now. So it's just, oh my goodness. Interesting.
It is. And what's even nastier about that, Mike, is the following, is that when you have supply side inflation, the tricky part about that is if you increase interest rates, knowing some of it and some of inflation generally is going to be demand driven. What you're doing is you're unfortunately tipping the scales towards slower growth as a way of fighting the inflation. But if you can't fight all of it through higher interest rates, you have this sort of lingering specter of continued slower growth because the supply side of the economy will not relinquish that relatively high price level.
Yeah.
So with higher rates and higher inflation, and I'm not saying we're going to have this, but that starts to creep in the specter of stagflation, where jobs are going to be lost due to higher interest rates and a slowdown in business investment, mm-hmm. at the same time that nasty inflation rate is not getting down to the point where consumers are thinking, wow, this is actually going to get cured.
Mm-hmm.
And then they slow down their demand. And then that starts to permeate a lot of different markets. So that's the game right now, is will the supply side kind of solve itself, and will higher interest rates exacerbate or solve the problem because it'll time itself well on the demand side?
Yeah.
That's why so many central banks have been a little hesitant to start raising rates in earnest.
Right. Oh, God. You've been doing this for a while. Have you ever seen a situation like this before? Because it's so unique what we're experiencing right now.
Not in my, let's say, professional lifetime, but there certainly have been times in which, if you look at the late 1970s and early 1980s, we had an episode where we had relatively high interest rates, trying to fight relatively high inflation, primarily because we had a supply shock due to oil prices rising. Now, we've had oil prices rise this time, but we've had general supply side seizures that still have some aspects floating around globally. And it's very hard for me to actually use that time as a strong comparison to now, because there were so many different effects. And then the monetary policy experiments we kind of did into the Volcker era in late 1970s, early 1980s is not really what we're trying to do now. And are looked at as kind of, this is why you don't do monetary policy this way. Though they ultimately did cure the inflation problem, it's hard to know which one was more, because we had oil prices dropping simultaneously. But sorry, I'm lingering a little bit.
That's okay. No worries.
The point is that in my professional lifetime, no, but in, let's say, post-World War II era, late 1970s, early 1980s is a somewhat similar time in terms of having sort of both sides kind of explaining why inflation is changing.
Mm-hmm.
But it tells you how hard it is when those things are changing simultaneously to solve the problem.
Yeah. I remember those when I was a wee little lad. I remember those days, and I remember the gas lines and
totally. You can only go on certain days of the week based on your license plate and all that craziness. Totally. I remember my mom being in a line too. So but I don't think we're going back to that. And we really are much better at central banking over the last 40 years as a result of that lesson that was learned. The key is whether or not we can have the global economy solve the supply side stuff. And of course, that's been exacerbated by a bunch of global issues, including what's happening with Ukraine and continuing on into the unforeseeable future.
Yeah.
All that stuff is sort of unfortunately colluding to still exacerbate the supply side issues we saw with the pandemic.
Yeah. Let's switch gears to housing, which is still a very interesting, another interesting area of the economy. What are you seeing there? Because, I mean, what a difference a year makes. I mean, this time last year, are you kidding me? So now what are we seeing right now, and what are we going to experience in 2023?
Yeah, well, just think about a year ago, right? We had historically low interest rates, very similar to what we saw for most of the 2010s. And we had it coupled with equity market gains and jobs growth. And so all of the aspects of having a relatively hot housing market were all coming together at the same time, right?
Perfect storm.
Well, just like any other cycle, three things happened. One, interest rates started to pick up. And as the more and more we soak up credit to buy those houses, we had to expect that on the demand side. The second side, the supply side of the lending market started to contract as the Federal Reserve got more aggressive in 2022 with interest rates. And the third thing is there was probably some pricing fatigue, that even at the relatively higher prices, if I want to make that investment, and rates are still, not shockingly historically high, the key is whether or not I really think that that house is worth another 250 or 300 grand.
Yeah.
So that game, all three of those sort of moving parts have led to this sort of slow devolution down in housing prices. And so one of the things I've been trying to watch is listing prices. Because generally on the backside of a housing pickup, homeowners who see profits from their neighbors who sold 6 or 8 months ago are relatively hesitant to start slashing prices if they're going to put their house on the market. But once you see that downturn really kick in, that's when you're going to start to see housing prices go down. And I think it'll probably be at a 10 or 15% cut across most of California. But if you look over around the United States, there's pockets.
Yeah.
Since I live in California, I'm watching California more specifically. But if you look in places like Florida, Arizona, Montana, Tennessee, places that got really red hot because of this migration pattern that took place as a result of the pandemic, plus people moving out of rental that was relatively high priced into home buying when the case, when the conditions were really good to do that, you should see a contraction at a little faster speed. Some of it's mathematics in the sense that you're starting at a lower level, thus the percentage change can be a little faster down. Mm-hmm. But those hot markets should see some fade in 2023 and maybe early 2024, given that the conditions have almost completely reversed. The key, and this is really the aspect of it. The lingering aspect of that will depend a lot on the local labor market. So if there's not a sharp contraction in labor, the housing prices are going to be somewhat, in a sense, somewhat supported at relatively high levels. And it will also depend on how fast housing building is taking place. So if we're not putting a lot of new units on and that slows down in terms of some kind of shaping the cycle, we should see housing prices fade, but not necessarily giving up all the wealth gains that we just had since 2020.
Yeah, no
doubt.
That's,
I think, we've got a lot of people sweating it.
Well, and the interest rates are having an effect as well. So, because nobody wants to get a, when you could get an interest rate at, 3% or whatever, and now it's 7-8, nobody wants to buy a house and when it's in that area, right? Or
So one of the real futurist thinking about this is, okay, we were at 7-8% mortgage. Let's just hypothesize that we're going to have that as sort of a short term peak. Well, if you look back in history, I've paid 7% for a mortgage.
I did too. My first house. Right? Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So, and same with me. And so we have to have a historic perspective about what the current mortgage rate really means, right? If I'm circumventing rent and I'm building wealth and I want to be in my home long term, is 7% that big of a deal in the short term, where if rates fade and all the ideas around the macro economy suggest that we will have a fade of interest rates, and I'll come back to this in just a second, it may be 24 and 25, such that it kind of moderates where we probably should be anyway.
Sure.
I'll refi.
You refi, right? Exactly. So, I was saying the same thing.
Right. So you see through that lens, is right now a bad time to jump into a house? And it should depend on A, do you need the cash flow? B, are you trying to circumvent relatively high rent? And three, do you intend to be in that area long term, where having the house and rooting yourself is the right idea for you and your family? Okay. Now, let's flip it the other side. In late 2008 and early 2009, we saw rates drop very quickly down to what we call the zero lower bound. And that drug mortgage rates right down with it indirectly, but basically contracted due to a bunch of different forces conspiring, including really aggressive moves by the Federal Reserve and also a reduction in the way we were taking loans. Now, will people who were 18 years old in 2008, who were my students, how many years have they seen rates come back down to that zero lower bound in such a way to say, look, there's no way I'm buying a house at 7, because what's going to happen 4 years from now, we're going to go down to the zero lower bound. So I'll just wait for that and I won't have to take on the refi costs. So one of the things you're going to have to watch for is to see how much the last, let's say, 15 years of monetary policy and rates following what's happened with policy, and I shouldn't say 15, 13 and a half, 14 years, has slipped down in such a way that now the expectations around interest rates are so low that that's what's going to lead to the sort of avoidance of a relatively high mortgage, is I'll just wait it out.
Yeah, yeah.
And in kind of a weird way, it can act as a self-fulfilling prophecy. If you say, man, I'm not taking a loan, banks and credit unions are suddenly going to have to get relatively aggressive on rates if they want to push loans out on the mortgage side. Absolutely. And it can creep it back. But no one should expect zero lower bound again anytime soon. We had two really weird events lead to that monetary policy movement.
Right.
And so we got to be very careful of having that as our baseline expectation for where mortgages should be at 3.25 ad infinitum.
Yeah.
So that's that educational piece is one of the biggest things that credit unions can do. And that's why we're so good as credit union industry about educating people, is that say, look, let's get realistic about where we really should be.
Right, right. Isn't that the mindset of your students in 2008 though? That's how they're thinking, right?
Because we've had two episodes now, right? So mortgages were 3.25 in 2012, and then they repeated themselves in 2020 and 2021. So why would not by 2026 or 7 then repeat again, right?
Yeah.
So one of the trickiest things is really being realistic and as lenders trying to educate the public and specifically the members about, hey, look, try to think about what buying a house really means. And it should be a long-term financial goal for you to own a home.
Mm-hmm.
Does that fit your long-term financial ability to achieve that goal or not?
Right.
If it does, you know, get yourself in there.
Go for it.
Work it out and then refi later when rates slip back a little bit. But prices going up at that pace is, like I said earlier, one of the other three sort of legs of the stool of why we might be falling back a little bit is because of price fatigue, right? People are also going to think, not only are rates relatively high, but why would I put myself in a house that A is almost guaranteed to lose value in the short term? So if I don't know if I'm going to stick around, what I don't know is I don't want to lose $100,000 because I'm only going to be here 3 years and it might take 3 years to work through the cycle.
Yeah.
And then the second thing is that you're thinking, was the run up almost like a bubble? So that what's really nasty as an economist and trying to shape people's thinking about how to deal with housing as part of your portfolio is that on the one side, I say, look, think in the long term. But if your life is not a long term situation in that geographic area, you have to think short term. And I think to a certain extent, we also have almost commoditized housing in the United States in some ways that either A, I'm going to leave this house and go to a bigger one later or even downsize if now I'm aging. But that it's basically another fungible asset like, you know, stocks or bonds in my portfolio.
Completely. Yeah. Oh, completely. And I remember going back to that. I mean, we were over for our first time, we were over the moon with a 7% interest. We were like, oh my gosh, yes.
Yeah. I mean, we were
so happy with about me.
And since I felt like, hey, not only my recent history and you know, general macro history suggested that people paid a lot more for this, but I don't have to rent anymore.
Yeah.
So in a sense, I was kind of looking, well, if you think about what we could rent at for this much space, the interest payment as a way of building wealth.
You're building wealth. That's right. That's the key word. Oh my gosh, Robert, I could talk to you all day about this stuff, but I know you have not only one job, but two jobs to do. So last question here. Hey, what can credit unions do to prepare for 2023 and all in these? I know it's a big question, but if you can kind of summarize it, and helping members and even helping themselves too of what's to come.
Yeah, I think the two main things that credit unions already do really well, but really need to double down on is one is education and letting their members know, you know, we will get through this. If you lose your job, let us know and we'll try to work with you. If it's getting tough to stay in your home, let us know and we'll work with you. I think the pandemic was a really good showcase of how credit unions, one, and banks generally as 1A, really saw took the lessons from the Great Recession and said, we cannot repeat this. So we got to get in and try to intervene on bad decision-making before people start taking it. And the forbearance and just sort of the delay of creating problems was a really smart move. And I think it in many ways forced a trough in what could have been much deeper in the pandemic. Mm-hmm. The second thing is just preparing for a flatter yield curve, a higher cost of funds. There's going to be more competition in terms of reattracting deposits as they've now left after relatively historic highs of deposit growth, And we know that it's going to be tougher to sell loans in 2023, given the things we talked about over the last 5-7 minutes. So I think a lot of credit unions are going to have relatively high loan growth as part of their strategic plan for 2023 and maybe even beyond. But I think being realistic about what the market actually will bear and how much uncertainty currently remains in terms of people jumping into a home and educating them about what they should be doing. Yeah. That, like I said earlier, that job market issue, if jobs start to contract relatively quickly, specifically in certain geographic areas, that's going to make for a little bit more housing market chaos than we're expecting. And unfortunately, there's going to be a huge hot white light on housing markets in 2023, given we don't want to give back those gains. But then realistically thinking, if you're up 50% in your home over the last 3.5 years, giving back 20% is okay because you're still up compounded pretty good over a 3 or 4 year stretch. But again, people are somewhat myopic about the way they think about that. So, you know, they're not thinking more than 3 years ahead. They're just thinking, wow, I just took a tank on 25%. I should have sold a year ago. I mean, I don't know how many times I've been sitting there listening to people talk about and lamenting the loss of 20%, forgetting they gained 50.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and you hit the nail on the head when you're thinking long term. You know, you're going to get that back. So okay.
And that the problem is, like I said, really with housing markets, we've commoditized that. Yeah. We're in kind of a weird test period about how much we've done that, and we'll see how many existing units go up in the next 12 months.
Yeah. Oh my gosh, very interesting times coming up next year, indeed. So, Robert, thank you so much for coming on again. I could talk to you all day.
Thank you so much.
Stuff really interesting. So, keep up the good work there, and look forward to having you on. Let's do it more often in 2023 because it's going to be a lot of fun to talk about for sure.
Yeah. Let me know for sure. I'd love to do it. And thank you again for having me.
Okay. Anytime, Robert.